Coten asked me today to speak a bit about River Master. And I think you have the right to ask me to do that. I was a chaplain to her for 21 years, so I should have some good stories to tell. And I did witness many things that were wonderful and inspiring. Many of them were recorded in Lotus Blossom. Others pertain to other monks. Those are their stories to tell. Some pertaining to myself are perhaps still a little too personal to my own training to me feel comfortable in telling it. But in thinking about it, what I realized was that most of the stories I have to tell are extremely ordinary. I could, for instance, tell you what type of soup River Master Jiu liked. It was homemade cream of tomato. She loved cream of tomato soup, and as a diabetic, the prepared canned varieties have so much sugar in them, she could only have a little cup. And tomatoes are, I gather, a freebie for diabetics, and milks you have a fair amount of. So, since she really loved cream of tomato soup, I frequently made it for her. Darn hard stuff to keep from curdling at the last moment. One of my little koans trying to keep the tomato soup from curdling. But that was her favorite soup, I could tell you about that. I could tell you how much insulin it took to keep her going in the last years of her life, and 101 other personal medical details, which I'm not going to tell you because they are personal medical details. I could tell you where she liked to shop. Anywhere you could get good merchandise at a bargain. River Master Jiu loved a bargain. I could tell you how she liked her car driven. Speed limit plus or minus 3 miles an hour, no more. Easy on the brake and steady as she goes. I could tell you her favorite type of dog. Moist kind. I never figured that one out. It wasn't the moisture that she liked. We always had to have a towel. We chaplains had to have a moist and dry towel available to wipe up dog moisture that would get on her and all over the place. So it wasn't the moisture in particular, but for some reason she liked the type of dog. First bulldogs, and then bulldogs were bad enough. Then we got the bloodhound. It's as moist as a bulldog, but its range is about 10 times larger. I can tell you what kind of cat she liked. Any kind at all. I can tell you how she voted. Generally liberal, with the exception of school bond issues, where she would grumble something. I used to fill out her ballot for her when she couldn't see too well, because she sort of, she trusted me to do that and not be influenced by her decisions. And she knew that, since we knew each other well enough to know that I would not be. She also knew that I was cussed enough that I wouldn't. Anyway, she'd always grumble about more prisons for kids for the crime of being born. And said she wasn't going to vote for any more schools until they did something about the education system. So I could tell you 101 of these little stories about how Reverend Master was a human being. And in thinking about that, it occurred to me that, well, maybe that's my story. Maybe my story is that our Master was a human being. Maybe that, in and of itself, is a story worth telling. Now, you've all heard many times that a teacher is a human being, and that we are all human beings, and that to live by Zen is the same as to live an ordinary daily life, as Dogen puts it. But doing that is different from hearing it and thinking about it. And doing that and having a teacher who does that is no easy thing, and it is a wonderful thing. It is not an easy thing because having a teacher who is a live human being, requires of one that one confront one's own humanity day by day, moment by moment, and train within it. And it is hard to know how to both accept one's own humanity and at the very same time train as if one's hair were on fire. It's hard for several reasons. First, there is a certain ambiguity, a certain complexity in this training. How do you know what the best you can do is? Reverend Master Geo often said, all that the unborn asks of us is that we do the best we can do. But how do you know what is the best within your humanity? Even when there is profound spiritual experience and a great sense of certainty, there is still the question, and what do I do now? There is, yes, and what next? What do I do? How do I apply this? Even the greatest senses of spiritual certainty do not absolve us of having to decide, having to sense, having to find that which is the next thing to do. There is complexity. How do we distinguish between the biddings of self and the biddings and the simple limitations of our own humanity? And how do we distinguish, without judging, between those things and the Buddha nature? How do we sense what is the ideal in our heads and what is the real, capital R? These are not easy things, and there are no simple formulas for doing these things. And thirdly, how do we accept our limits as a human being? Accepting our limits, yet not falling over into making excuses for ourselves and doing less than what is our best. How do we know what is a true human limitation simply to be accepted? And how do we know what is just a little bit of slacking off from the best? In that regard, I think that I saw it well put, not in a Buddhist context, but in the context of the AA Serenity Prayer, which I encountered in the psychology, which seems to me very good Buddhism. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, I hope I've got it right, it is something like the following. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I thought that was pretty darn good Buddhism. So, with this ambiguity, with this complexity, with these limitations of the human body and mind, we have to somehow train with those things, live with a teacher who trains with those things. And that's not easy. As I said, first of all, because it brings us into contact day to day with our own humanity. It forces us, whether we will or not, to look at these things. And if we will not, then we pay a price. We pay a price of foisting delusion of some sort on ourselves. And the usual delusion we foist has to do with what I call magic. One of the main things that I have observed, both in myself and me and others, as to why we find it sometimes so difficult to train with a real, live, human master or teacher. It's because we want something from that teacher that they cannot give. They cannot give it because it doesn't exist. And that is magical solutions to our training. And the closer we are to that teacher, the more these things come into focus. And so the greater the ability to benefit, and also the harder sometimes it is on the little old self. I want to talk some about this magic business, because I keep finding it cropping up here, there, and everywhere in expectations and thoughts about training and about teachers. Now, when I say magic, I'm going to sort of define it idiosyncratically, but maybe not totally idiosyncratically. I'm not referring to what the use that's sometimes made of it as wonderful, unexpected, positive things. Okay? I'm not referring to that sense of magic. And I'm not referring to the CDs or limited psychic abilities that sometimes arise with long-term training. I'm not denying that there are aspects of this Buddhist training of ours which are beyond access to the rational mind. What I am referring to is that the laws of the universe, not being conformable to our own will, cannot be made to do so through shortcuts. I.e., there's no easy way around the ambiguity, the complexity, and the human limitations of training within humanity. And actually, this definition isn't too far off from the commonly accepted one. I looked it up in the OED before I started this. It's got a pretty good definition of magic for our purposes. The first definition says, the pretend art, pretend, i.e. we are deluding ourselves, of influencing the course of events. Ah, yes, that's what we want to do, isn't it? We want to make things happen the way we want them. And of producing marvelous physical phenomena. Well, great. Let's throw that in as a bonus. Let's have some marvelous things, because we're attracted to the glitter of marvelous things. By processes supposed to owe their efficacy to the power of compelling the intervention of spiritual beings. Well, we don't believe in beings so much as spiritual whatever, forces or whatever. Okay, compelling is the useful word here. We want to be in control, in other words. We want to be in control of the course of our training and make it the way we want it to. Or bringing into operation, says the dictionary, some occult, i.e. mysterious or not understood, controlling principle of nature. Again, we want to be in charge, and we want to have it our way. And we are deluded enough to think that if we did, it would actually be what we wanted. Careful, Reverend Master used to say, careful what you wish for. Sometimes when things go the way you want them to, you find out that, oh dear, that wasn't the way I wanted it at all. Now, this magic business, we human beings, I include myself, very much so, we always seem to be falling for it, both in our secular lives and in our religious lives. In our secular lives, well, look who we generally vote for. He or she who promises the easy, painless fix. Then he or she doesn't solve all of our problems without raising taxes, so we throw the bum out and vote for the next one who promises the easy, simple fix. In economics, we're always looking out for the free lunch. Why is it that people are so easily bamboozled by confidence people? Generally, because they think they're going to get something for nothing. Even in our personal lives, we fall for it. This will date me, but what the hey. Songwriters love magic. I remember a Beatles song, All You Need Is Love. And it was a great lyric. I really was very much attracted to that. And yes, love is a fine beginning to a relationship. But as most of you of your age by now have figured out, there's some work involved as well. It isn't all you need is love. On a somewhat sadder note, there was a song, I think, by The Doors. It had a line, this is back in the days of the Haight Ashbury, and I will admit I used to be there. Worked for the Free Medical Clinic at the time. And I was sitting in my office up there on Clayton Street, looking down on this sea of young humanity with no place to live, no money, hungry, tired, cold. And The Doors were putting out this song, that one of the lines of which was, "You get here and we'll do the rest." Well, they were there by the thousands and nobody was doing the rest. It was part of my job to say, "Hey kid, sorry, but it isn't the way the songs say it is." So we're falling for magic. And religion seems to be particularly rife with it. Now, some religions, and I'm afraid here I'm going to be a little less than ecumenical, forgive me, I'm getting grumpier in my old age. Some religions seem primarily based on magic, i.e. ways of getting what you want, and sort of compelling the gods or whatever to do what you want. But Buddhism isn't supposed to be one of those. And if you think I'm grumpy about it, listen to old Reverend Dogen on the topic. This is from Kiebu Posopo, one of the chapters of the Shobogenzo. This is from the Nishiyama and Stevens translation. And Dogen says the following. Shakyamuni Buddha said, "Ordinary people, out of fear," keep that in your back pocket, I'm coming back to that, out of fear, often take refuge in the deities of mountains, gardens, forests, individual trees, of ancient tombs. What a complete waste of time. Who ever heard of anyone being released from pain and suffering in this way? And he talks about various rituals that people do to these beings and whatnot. Such rituals, we should know, do not provide shelter from suffering. Others have suggested various means for gaining release from suffering and fulfillment of wishes. Among them, they recommend imitating the actions of a cow, eating deer food, mimicking the antics of demons, and goes on to list, 101 sort of shamanistic practices. Further, they suggest that we can achieve the same by smearing the body with ash, growing long hair, casting spells following the sacrifice of a sheep, worshipping the god of fire for 4 months, fasting for 7 days, or offering 100,000 flowers to the celestial beings. What groundless, meaningless rubbish! Exclamation point. To be born a human is extremely difficult, let alone to also encounter the Buddhist Dharma. When we have been fortunate on both of these accounts, it would indeed be more than tragic if, as a result of mistaken views, we were to spend our lives in the service of infantile deities. Okay. Some of Dogen's writing, which is particularly hot like this, I always wondered a bit about why he did that. And in collaborating with Reverend Hubert in doing some of the editing for the translations he's doing, he's uncovered some interesting things that help me understand why Dogen is so very tolerant in some places and gets really hot under the collar in others. And the hot ones may, in part, be due to several things I didn't know were going on in Dogen's time. One was that a goodly number of his disciples were converts from another school of Buddhism that no longer exists, another school of Zen called the Dharmashu, the Bodhidharma school, not founded by Bodhidharma, but founded by a guy who was essentially self-taught, had no teacher. And so a number of his community were converts from that school of Zen. And on a number of points, Dogen was essentially talking to them and saying, look, gang, okay, a real live teacher is necessary. Kinds of practices like some of the ones talked about here, which were somewhat involved in that school Buddhism, or esoteric Buddhism type practices, are not the way you're going to find it. And he sort of thumps the table, in part, at this bunch of his disciples who had come from that tradition. Another aspect of it when he gets hot like that is understandable from apparently the way the Japanese language was used, at least at the time of Dogen, and that is that part of the meaning is conveyed by the emotional tone of the language. And that if, for instance, Dogen were simply to say what we would say, which is, this is important, that would not get across as being important. The way you got something across as being important was to get worked up about it. And that communicated, I take this particularly seriously, please do likewise. So sometimes when you read some of Dogen and he's sort of taking his shoe off metaphorically and pounding on the table, part of what he may be doing is saying, hey, this is important stuff. That may help you understand why he seems so tolerant and sometimes and so intolerant, apparently, to us and others. It may be some of these other things going on. So what he was saying here, then, is, hey, it's important that you not get caught in magic. And unfortunately, humans, being as we are, magical expectations, to the extent that we do have them in training, tend to focus on our teacher. They focus right on the teacher like bees on a clover blossom. And this is not new. It's been that way probably forever. And is one of the reasons why it is, first of all, very important to have a teacher, because it brings this out. It's one of the many reasons why it's important. And also why it is difficult to live with one, if it's a real, live, breathing human. River Master Gio, on this point, means the Stem of the Lotus chapter of Zen's Eternal Life. The tragedy of most Western people in Japan, and this applies here too, is that they are hunting for a, quote, God the Father, unquote, figure, who will teach them everything. This is wrong. They must do Zazen and realize that no one can help them except themselves. They must clearly understand that all things are teaching at all times, if they are truly looking for teaching. Anything or anyone that is the catalyst for the realization of Zen truths for a person is Buddha. If the reader is searching for a special person as a, quote, master, unquote, he will get nowhere, for he is very definitely in the world of the opposites. He is saying one thing is Buddha and another is not. Do not be misled by the popular trend in the West of going master hunting. Again, master hunting with master in quotes. Looking, I would put it, for magical things. Looking for magical solutions from another being. Why do we keep falling for this? I think there are several reasons. One could be as simple as the fact that we can think. We humans get used to taking our thoughts and making sort of a little map of our world out of them and operating on the basis of that map, and it works pretty well. So we get used to taking thoughts as representations of reality. And it's a very fine step from that to the proposition, well, if I can think it, maybe it's true. And we can think all sorts of things, including magical. Unfortunately, it doesn't make them true. But because we're so used to using our thoughts as, or making our thoughts the reality, then we get tempted, because we can think of something, to at least consider the possibility that it may be true, and if it's attractive, that it is true. A second reason I think we fall for it is that it works, at least for a little while. Magical ways of approaching training, magical expectations, whether in religion or in secular life, do bring an illusion of certainty, and they temporarily give one a certain power over things, and they certainly simplify or appear to simplify our lives. And so they are very, very attractive. But there is a terrible price to be paid when we actually act on them. That price is easiest to see in the secular world because it's so much more obvious, it's so much more gross, particularly, for instance, in the political section of the world. To take an extreme example of magical, simplistic thinking, well, we have one back in the earlier part of this century. Get rid of all the Jews and the Gypsies and the other misfits, and you'll have a master race and a Reich that'll last 1,000 years. Well, it's a very simple approach to reality, wasn't it? It worked for about 10 years, and we all know the horrors that came from that. In my current position, I find it useful to remind myself from time to time not to get caught by simplistic solutions to things, because they are so very attractive. One of the ways I remind myself is to try to quote certain people who have chosen simplistic solutions to things as a reminder of what happens when people who are in charge of organizations do that. Now, unfortunately, Mr. Hitler is hard to quote because he was so verbose. But Joe Stalin was a man of few words. So Dysewey sometimes quotes Joe Stalin. And one of my favorites is, you get rid of the person and you got rid of the problem. Now, Joe was a master of that, as we all know. It worked for almost a generation. Until it didn't work anymore. And of course, it didn't work at the time, but it gave the illusion of working. Joe got rid of a lot of problems that way. And that's no way to deal with one's problems. In the religious, quasi, sort of religious political sphere, another one I frequently quote, I don't know exactly which bishop it was that said this. This is a bishop in the, I guess it was in the Renaissance, I'm not sure exactly, in southern France, when the church at the time was chasing some poor bunch of free thinkers. They were always chasing free thinkers in southern France. I'm not sure which bunch they were chasing at the moment. But the bishop was provided with an army and a general for the purpose of eradicating free thinkers in southern France. And they went from town to town, city to city, the cities that were inhabited by this sect of free thinkers, and basically gave them an ultimatum. You either turn the city over and all convert back to the true faith, you know, or we raise the city and slaughter you all. Very simple approach in and of itself. Unfortunately, it got too complicated in this one city because the residents of this particular city were roughly equally distributed between members of the true faith and the particular sect of free thinkers they were trying to get rid of. And so the general came to His Eminence the Bishop and said, well, Your Eminence, what shall I do? Half of these people are members of the church. His Eminence came up with what I frequently quote, which is a very tidy solution to this. He said, kill them all. God will know his own. So if you hear your friendly head of the order quoting Stalin or whoever this bishop was, it is to try to remind myself that we human beings get tempted to find very simple, very tidy solutions to making our world the way we think we want it, and that the price of doing that is exceedingly high. So I think we do it because we can think, and I think we do it because it does bring this illusion of simplicity and certainty, but mostly I think we do this magical stuff for the reasons Dogen said, and that is because we're afraid. We're afraid we can't do it in religious training. We're afraid we're not good enough. And therefore, we want the teacher to give it to us. Now, this is not something that is new. One of the works in the Buddhist canon that Daisui finds most interesting is an obscure little thing called The Points of Controversy, which is a part of the Abhidhamma. Now, the Abhidhamma is a whole section of the canon. There's the sutras, and there's the Vinayas. And then there's the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma is a section which most monks roll their eyes back up inside their sockets when you mention it, because by and large, it is this abstruse philosophical commentaries and explanations and lists a mile long of the properties of this and that and whatnot. But in amongst that, there are some little jewels. And this particular book, Points of Controversy, lists things which Buddhists were arguing about around 2,000 years ago, around 250 BC. And it is delightfully remarkable how the things we worry about today, they've been worrying about since 250 BC. And one of them has to do with this, the proposition that the master or the teacher can give it to us. And here's one aspect of it. The particular aspect that this one is talking about here has to do with religious happiness, okay? And the essentially the joy of nirvana. The controverted point that one can bestow happiness on others. Commentary. This view is derived by its inheritance, notably the Hetavadins, from a sutra quoted below. And this is the sutra. This is a section of the sutra. The Venerable Buddhayan said, "Verily, of many unhappinesses doth the Exalted One rid us. Many happinesses does he bestow upon us. Of many bad things does he rid us. Many good things doth he bestow upon us." Unquote. But the words of the Exalted One were spoken to show how the arising of happiness in others is conditioned. Producing happiness in others is not like bestowing food on them. Your proposition implies that one could also cause misery in others. But you deny this while you maintain the opposite in respect to happiness. You further imply that you could hand over your own happiness to another, or others' happiness to others yet again, or one's happiness to yet a third party. This you deny. Then to whom can these things be given? You imply, finally, that anyone causes another to act for him, that one's own welfare and ill are wrought by another, that one acts while the other experiences. In other words, the denial of the law of karma, one of the fundamental laws of the universe. And by the way, that's what all this magical stuff boils down to one way or another, is the denial of one of the laws of the universe, of wanting it to operate differently in the way it does. And people have been wanting it for a long, long time, and thinking that somehow, in this case, the teacher can bestow happiness upon one, or understand the other one's going. If it can bestow understanding. No, that isn't the way it works. They can be a condition and a catalyst, but nothing gets given, not even in the transmission ceremony. It is not a giving of one to another, but a mutual flowing between, mutual recognition. It is not a, here, I've got it, you can now have some, kind of thing. But that's what we want, if we're afraid that we can't do it. But all of Buddhism says you can do it. You can do it through the Eightfold Path, meditation being one aspect, and the precepts being other aspects, the expression of gratitude in daily life being another. you can do it, and you can know you can do it, because a live Greenwood teacher is doing, has done, and will do it right alongside of you while still being human. And that challenges the assumption that I'm not good enough. Another thing that we're afraid of is that humanity itself isn't good enough. That somehow the teacher must be a Superman. And by giving you the secrets, you can be a Superman too. But we aren't Superman. And neither is the teacher. We are human. No more, no less. And it is enough to be a human. And not only is it enough, it is the best possible state for training and realization of the truth. You've heard it all before, but I'll say it again, quoting Dogen's Shoshogi on this point. It is very difficult to be born as a human being, and equally difficult to find Buddhism. However, because of the good karma that we have accumulated, we have received the exceptional gift of a human body and are able to hear the truths of Buddhism. We therefore have the greatest possibility of a full life within the limits of birth and death. It would be criminal to waste such an opportunity by leaving this weak life of ours exposed to impermanence through lack of faith and commitment. It is enough, in other words, to be a human being, and it is enough to be your particular human being. And thus, the teacher's humanity is one of the greatest gifts, as it were, and I use this not in the magical sense, but in the sense of an offering, that the teacher can give. The offering of their training beside you within their humanity. Because as you see that they are both trained and that they are human, it is living proof that it is enough to be human and to be you. And that is uncomfortable because it means there are really no more excuses. Now this magic stuff that we get attracted to doesn't work. And why doesn't it work? Well, it doesn't work, first of all, because it is an illusion. The laws of the universe are not conformable to our own will. Even the Buddhas cannot change the operation of the laws of the universe. And again, this is something that people have been trying to get around since 250 BC and before. Still running? Yes, controverted point. That either a Buddha or his disciples have the power of supernormally performing whatever they wish. Commentary. Siddhi, that is, the powers of psychic stuff that sometimes comes from long-term training meditation, is only possible in certain directions. It is absolutely impossible by it to contravene such things as the law of impermanence in Nietzsche, for example. Do you wish to imply that either the Buddha or the disciples could affect such wishes as let the trees always be green, always blossoming, always in fruit, let there be perpetual moonlight, let there be a constant abundance of alms, let there always be an abundance of grain, or such wishes as let this factor of consciousness that has arisen not cease, or such wishes as let this body or this mind be permanent, or let beings subject to birth, old age, disease, and death not be born, not grow old, not be unfortunate, and not die, i.e. listing all the things we'd like to have happen magically. All of this you must deny. Then wherein lies your proposition? So the fundamental problem, if you wish, with magic is that it is an illusion, that it doesn't work. There are some more specific ways in which it doesn't work, which are useful to look at in religious training. One of the specifics is that there are no shortcuts. And since there are no shortcuts, the teacher can't give you any shortcuts. As it says, again, in the Zazen rules, nor is it possible to understand training and enlightenment by supernatural means. And we trainees have always been looking for shortcuts. We do to this day, and we have been right since the days of the Buddha. The Buddha himself counseled his monks on this aspect of trying to find shortcuts. And this is what he had to say. This is from the gradual signs of the solitary. Monks, there are these three urgent duties of a yeoman farmer. What three? Herein, monks, the yeoman farmer gets his field well plowed and harrowed quickly. Having done so, he puts his seed in quickly. Having done that, he lets the water in and turns it off again quickly. These are his three urgent duties. Now, monks, that yeoman farmer has no such magical power or authority as to say, quote, let my crops spring up today, tomorrow let them ear, on the following day let them ripen, unquote. No, it is just due to the due season that makes them do this. In the same way, there are these three urgent duties of a monk. What are these? The undertaking of the training in the higher morality, in the higher thought, and in the higher insight, in other words, precepts, understanding, and meditation. These are his three urgent duties. Now, the monk has no such magic power or authority as to say, quote, today let my mind be released from the hindrances without grasping, or tomorrow, or the day following, unquote. No, it is just the due season which releases his mind as he undergoes the training in these three. So, folks have been wanting shortcuts right since day one, and there aren't any. Well, I shouldn't say that. You want a shortcut? You want a shortcut? Okay. I'll give you a shortcut. This is from the chapter in the Shobo Genzo, known as Uji. I'm going to read you the last... it's from Shoji. Sorry. This is the... version in Zen's Eternal Life. It's the last few passages from Shoji. And in one way, the translation in Nishiyama and Stevens, the first sentence, is even more seductive as a hook to get you into it. The Nishiyama Stevens translation of the first sentence I'm going to quote is, there is an easy way to Buddhahood. everybody on the edge of the seat? Her master translation is, the way to Buddhahood is easy. This is a little more straightforward. It doesn't have quite the same hook to it. But here's the easy way. They who do not perpetrate evil, they who do not grasp at life and death, but work for the good of all living things with utter compassion, giving respect to those older and loving understanding to those younger than themselves, they who do not reject, search for, think on, or worry about anything, have the name of Buddha. You must look for nothing more. That's a good thing. Another way in which magic in our training does not work is that there are no signs or portents to make it simple and unambiguous as to what to do next, or to take away the necessity of perceptual ethical discernment. One of the things which makes Daishui grumpy sometimes is when he hears someone say, well, I was doing such and such, but it didn't go well, so I guess I wasn't supposed to be doing that anyway. I start to growl, at least inside. I try to be better, not actually verbally growl, but I do occasionally. Now, wait just a minute there. Please quote me, person. I would love you to find for me Latin scriptures in the last 24 years. I ain't found that one yet. Now, I was with Reverend Master Gio for the last 24 years. And I don't remember her saying it would always be easy. So where do we get this? Well, it wasn't going well, so I mustn't have been supposed to do it anyway, stuff from. Now that's not to say that one does not involve an intuitive sense of when one is going blindly along, like a bull in a china shop, doing all sorts of harm, and one had better put the brakes on because one is doing harm. That is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about this notion that there's somehow a fate out there or something which is in control of it all and is going to give me these little signs and portents that are going to make it possible to know exactly what the next thing to do is. I have even seen Reverend Master Ju's teaching tried to be turned into that. Her own teaching tried to be turned into that. You're familiar with some of her writings in Lotus Blossom and her Kyoju Kaiman commentary, where she says in one point, "And always I must ask of the Lord before I do anything." And that is an exquisite teaching. And a teaching that has many applications. I don't have the time to go into them now. But I'll tell you one of them that isn't. It isn't a shortcut to training. And I have seen people try to make it such. Literally, take it on its most simplistic, literal meaning, and sit there, and when the mashed potatoes come down for seconds at the table, sit there, stop, ask the Lord whether they should take more mashed potatoes or not. And then ask them whether it's time to finish eating, and then ask whether it's time to get up, and then ask whether it's time to leave the room, etc., etc., etc. This does not work. And it was not what Reverend Master intended. In fact, when she heard about this, she blew her stack. Again, when you try to tell something, this is one of the little crosses that teachers bear, and that is, no matter what you say, it is subject to varying interpretations, and someone, somewhere, will come up with an interpretation you didn't intend. Well, that's one of the things you have to learn to live with as a teacher. But this particular one was not what you did. And it actually can become quite dangerous to a person to take these sorts of things as shortcuts. In this particular case, what will happen is, having done a certain amount of getting quiet and asking the Lord, sometimes with the Reverend Master, sometimes alone, I have a fairly good sense that basically the unborn doesn't answer questions like that, unless it's to give you a box on the ears for asking stupid questions. Or at most, a sense of as you wish, quiet as you wish. Now, if you in fact ignore what the still small voice within, I use voice metaphorically, although some people find it more than metaphorical. If you absolutely insist on ignoring that because you want magic, and you keep asking these dumb questions anyway, eventually the still small voice will shut up and something else will answer you. An aspect of yourself will answer you. It will pick up the slack and will go, whee! And you can get yourself into a fine mess of delusion, thinking that you have found a shortcut to training, but you haven't, because there aren't any. And signs and portents are a type of this shortcut. Now, I will quote you somebody else who gets a little bit grumpy, in this case, Keizan, on the subject of signs and portents. This is from a chapter in the Dankaroku on Shayata, which is rather the worst translation. In effect, Shayata was saying, quote, by believing in the Buddha's teaching, our lives ought to be long. This is Shayata before conversion. Ought to be long. By dint of the Buddha's teaching, our bodies ought to be in continual good health. Experiences ought to accord with what we fancy. But they do not. Our body falls victim to illness, etc. What have we done wrong? From the outset, Chandala, the outlaw, committed evil acts and cultivated no good deeds whatsoever, yet his body was fit and healthy. Assuming here that this is a significant favorable sign, how is this good fortune possible? Unquote. Okay, then. People still think like this today. Even some of you monks harbor such thoughts, to say nothing of lay people who are prone to this kind of thinking. This is why Kumarata said, why do you entertain such doubts? The karmic effects of good and bad actions will come to fruition in one of the three temporal phases. Okay? We've been at this. It's all the same. Same stuff. And it doesn't work. Another thing that doesn't work are simplistic formulas for training. And again, we humans, being human, we will try to find them. Now, one of the most commonly used simplistic formulas in all religions is what we may call fundamentalism. That is to say, a taking of the writings on a literal level. There are some problems with this. Any religion that has been around as long as ours has, and some of the other great religions, has so much in it at so many levels that it is impossible to take it literally without driving yourself nuts, because it conflicts with itself at different points if taken literally. So it can't have been meant to take literally. So what you do in the search for a simplistic formula is you take parts of it literally that what? Match what you want. And the other parts don't count. Now this is not to counter, and here you will have a problem if you take things literally, I'm going to say, what I just said is literally the opposite of what Reverend Master said at one point. And she said, for herself, I think it's the most possible, I must take the scriptures literally, for they were written at death's door. Now, if you take this literally, you now have a problem. Because Daisuke has said one thing, and his master said another. But there is no problem. Because what Reverend Master was talking about was an exceedingly beautiful, exceedingly important point in training, at which the scriptures, and there she was referring, by the way, to the scriptures of our morning service, open up in a depth and blossom in a fullness that is unthinkable to one who does not stop and allow them to sink into one's mind literally at that time, because there are meanings in them that will only blossom if you take them at that point in time absolutely literally. And then you go on. And having lived with Reverend Master for all those years, I can tell you that you do not take the scriptures literally in other senses at other times. And at some times, you go from literally and back and forth. Okay? So it's not a simple formula. Another simple formula that people like to try is to take every utterance of one's teacher as supreme teaching. Poor teacher. All those pairs of beady little eyes and pointy little ears taking in everything you say and do as the ultimate teaching. As a shortcut, as a simplistic formula of the point of the person doing. And it doesn't work. Because we're human beings. And not every twitch and burp of the teacher is ultimate teaching. And you're caught in the middle here, because you're caught no matter which way you turn on this one. If you do not take it all as supreme and ultimate teaching, then you run the risk of bringing the teaching of the teacher down to your level. And we know we're not supposed to do that. But if it isn't all ultimate teaching, then what do I do? You don't have to bring it down to your own level. You have to make room for the possibilities of humanity without judgment, and without bringing anything down to any level at all. Just make some room. Just have a wider sense of the universe. And have a universe in which there's room for the teacher to be a human being. And do not judge. And yes, it's risky. And if you don't do that, if you do take everything as literal teaching, and as every twitch as teaching, then you run a different sort of a risk. You will eventually drive yourself nuts with that. And you will come to a point where you come to a crisis of belief. Because eventually you will see that some things do not stand against other things. And then what do you do? Well, you can do the same thing. You can achieve a universe in which there's room for a human master and training within the truth on the part of that. But that's a harder and more crisis-fraught way of doing it than allowing for that in the beginning. And quite frankly, if you want to give a gift to a teacher, one of the greatest gifts that you can give to a teacher is to allow them to be a human being. It's very difficult. I know as Rebbe Master's chaplain, having seen this over the years, for a teacher to be able to relax and simply do the training of when you are hungry, eat, when you are tired, sleep, that sort of very human, ongoing training in a completely safe way without having everything looked at and dissected and examined by the students or the disciples. It is a great gift to a teacher to allow them to do that and not to be constantly clutching at them, constantly looking for magic. So if you want to give a gift to a teacher, give them the gift of a universe in which they too could be human. Go back to the points of controversy. This wanting of simplistic formulas, in particular the words of the teacher absolutely being always super mundane teaching, exalted teaching, goes all the way back. Controverted point that the exalted Buddha's ordinary everyday speech was super mundane. Let me put that in case this doesn't have exalted teachings there. Commentary, the Andakas hold that his daily usages were always super mundane usages. Does this not involve a further statement that his speech impinged only upon the spiritual but not upon the mundane ear, and that the spiritual, not the mundane, intelligence responded to it, and thus the disciples alone were aware of it and not average persons? You do not admit this. Nay, you know that the exalted Buddha's speech struck the mundane ear of men, was responded to by mundane intelligence, and that average persons were aware of it. Further, there were some who were offended by his habitual everyday speech. But is supreme teaching a thing to occasion hatred or anger or resentment? Is not rather the opposite the case? Further, there were some who were baffled by his everyday speech. But is super mundane teaching
an occasion for obfuscation, causing want of insight, blindness, extinguishing understanding, provoking vexation, and not conducing to nirvana? Is not rather the opposite the case? Now those who have heard the exalted Buddha's everyday speech, did they all develop the path? Yes, you say. But foolish people heard him too. Matricides and parasites, slayers of arahants, shedders of holy blood, schismatics. Therefore, do you affirm that all these develop the path? Indeed, I think we could say that it is the giving up of attachment to these sorts of magical desires and expectations that is one of the things to be given up in training. In fact, taking it all the way back to the earliest forms of Buddhism, it is one of the things that is listed, along with giving up the fetter of doubt and the fetter of belief in self, that characterizes entering the stream as a stream entrance, the giving up of these magical beliefs and expectations. So I would ask of you and offer to you that every master is a human being, but please don't forget that. Because now is the time at which we are at risk of starting to forget that. It's natural, following the passing away of a great person, for people to either start making them bigger than life, if they subtly want magic, or to start debunking them, if they have some reason to wish to not listen to what their teaching was and is. And neither is true. Reverend Master was just exactly like that. And what she did, you can do. What she found, you can find. Because you are like too. Now that doesn't mean we should not share wonderful stories and inspiring stories. This only that true of Reverend Master. Indeed we should. Indeed I intend to. Indeed please do. And for me, one of the most wonderful is that every once in a while, Reverend Master spilled their soup. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dhamma. Homage to the Dhamma.